Last Wednesday, the International Court of Justice unanimously ruled against the United States on a number of questions pertaining to Iran and sanctions. Iran had filed a lawsuit in late August claiming that the U.S. was in violation of the 1955 Treaty of Amity, Economic Relations, and Consular Rights between the two countries over the sanctions imposed against Iran. These are sanctions imposed after the U.S. withdrew from the JCPOA that was signed in 2015 between Iran, the U.S., the U.K., France, Russia, China, and Germany. What follows is a reading of the decision by the court. Again, this is this past Wednesday.
The sitting is open. The court meets today to deliver its decision on the request for the indication of provisional measures submitted by the Islamic Republic of Iran in the case concerning alleged violations of the 1955 Treaty of Amity, Economic Relations, and Consular Rights, Islamic Republic of Iran versus United States of America. I would recall that on 16 July 2018, the Islamic Republic of Iran filed in the registry of the court an application instituting proceedings against the United States with regard to alleged violations of the Treaty of Amity, Economic Relations and Consular Rights between Iran and the United States of America, which was signed at Tehran on 15 August 1955 and entered into force on 16 June 1957. I will refer to this treaty as the Treaty of Amity or the 1955 Treaty. On the same day, Iran submitted a request for the indication of provisional measures referring to Article 41 of the statute and to Article 73, 74, and 75 of the rules of court, aimed at safeguarding the rights it claims under the Treaty of Amity, pending the court's final decision in the case. In accordance with the usual practice, I shall not read the introductory paragraphs of the order, which set out the procedural history of the case. I shall also omit or summarize some other paragraphs. I shall accordingly begin the reading of the order at paragraph 16. The first section of the order briefly sets out the factual background to the case. Starting in 2006, the Security Council of the United Nations adopted a number of resolutions following reports by the International Atomic Energy Agency, which were critical of Iran's compliance with its obligations under the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, calling upon Iran to cease some of its nuclear activities. The Security Council also imposed sanctions in order to ensure compliance. Various states imposed additional sanctions on Iran. On 14 July 2015, China, France, Germany, the Russian Federation, the United Kingdom, and the United States, together with the High Representative of the European Union for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy and the Islamic Republic of Iran, adopted a long-term comprehensive plan of action, which I shall refer to as the JCPOA, or the plan, concerning the nuclear program of Iran. The declared purpose of that plan was to ensure the exclusively peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program and to produce, I quote, the comprehensive lifting of all UN Security Council sanctions as well as multilateral and national sanctions related to Iran's nuclear program, end of quotation. On 20 July 2015, the Security Council of the United Nations adopted Resolution 2231, 2015, endorsing the GCPOA. On 8 May 2018, the President of the United States issued a national security presidential memorandum announcing the end of the participation of the United States in the JCPOA and directing the reimposition of sanctions lifted or waived in connection with the JCPOA. The presidential memorandum determined that it was in the national interest of the United States to reimpose sanctions, and I quote, as expeditiously as possible and in no case later than 180 days, end of quotation, from the date of the memorandum. Simultaneously, the United States Department of the Treasury, Office of Foreign Assets Control, announced that sanctions would be reimposed in two steps. The United States would reimpose a certain number of sanctions upon expiry of a first wind-down period of 90 days, ending on 6 August 2018, and following a second wind-down period of 180 days, ending on 4 November 2018, the United States would reimpose additional sanctions. On 6 August 2018, the President of the United States issued Executive Order 13846, reimposing certain sanctions on Iran and Iranian nationals. Turning to the question of prima facie jurisdiction, the court recalls that it may indicate provisional measures only if the provision is relied on by the applicant appear prima facie to afford a basis on which its jurisdiction could be founded, but that it need not satisfy itself in a definitive manner that it has jurisdiction as regards the merits of the case. In the present case, Iran seeks to found the jurisdiction of the court on Article 36, paragraph 1 of the statutes of the court, and on Article 21, paragraph 2 of the Treaty of Amity. The court must first determine whether it has prima facie jurisdiction to rule on the merits of the case, enabling it, if the other necessary conditions are fulfilled, to indicate provisional measures. Article 21, paragraph 2 of the 1955 Treaty provides that, and I quote, any dispute between the high contracting parties as to the interpretation or application of the present treaty, not satisfactorily adjusted by diplomacy, shall be submitted to the International Court of Justice unless the high contracting parties agree to settlement by some other pacific means, end of quotation. The court must therefore verify prima facie two different requirements, namely that there exists a dispute between the parties and that this dispute concerns the interpretation or application of the 1955 treaty. As the court has repeatedly noted, a dispute between states exists where they hold clearly opposite views concerning the question of the performance or non-performance of certain international obligations. the claim of one party must be positively opposed by the other. The court observes that in the present case, the parties do not contest that a dispute exists between them. They differ, however, on the question whether this dispute related to the interpretation or application of the 1955 treaty. In order to determine whether the dispute between the parties concerns the interpretation or application of the 1955 treaty, the court cannot limit itself to noting that one of the parties maintains that the treaty applies while the other denies it. Rather, it must ascertain whether the acts complained of by the applicant are prima facie capable of falling within the provisions of that instrument and whether, as a consequence, the dispute is one which the court could have jurisdiction ratione materiae to entertain. The court considers that the fact that the dispute between the parties arose in connection with and in the context of the decision of the United States to withdraw from the JCPOA does not in and of itself exclude the possibility that the dispute relates to the interpretation or application of the Treaty of Amity. In general terms, certain acts may fall within the ambit of more than one legal instrument, and a dispute relating to those acts may relate to the interpretation or application of more than one treaty or other instrument. To the extent that the measures adopted by the United States following its decision to withdraw from the JCPOA might constitute violations of certain obligations under the 1955 treaty, such measures relate to the interpretation or application of that instrument. The court also observes that the JCPOA does not grant exclusive competence to the dispute settlement mechanism it establishes with respect to measures adopted in its context and which may fall under the jurisdiction of another dispute settlement mechanism. Therefore, the court considers that the JCPOA and its dispute settlement mechanism do not remove the measures complained of from the material scope of the Treaty of Amity, nor exclude the applicability of its compromissory clause. The court also notes that while Iran contests the conformity of the measures adopted with several provisions of the 1955 treaty, the United States expressly relies on Article 20, paragraph 1 of that treaty, which defines a limited number of instances in which, notwithstanding the provisions of the treaty, the parties may apply certain measures. Whether and to what extent those exceptions have lawfully been relied on by the respondent in the present case is a matter which is subject to judicial examination and hence forms an integral part of the material scope of the court's jurisdiction as to the interpretation or application of the treaty under Article 21, paragraph 2. The court considers that the 1955 treaty contains rules providing for freedom of trade and commerce between the United States and Iran, including specific rules prohibiting restrictions on the import and export of products originating from the two countries, as well as rules relating to the payment and transfer of funds between them. In the court's view, measures adopted by the United States, for example, the revocation of licenses and authorizations granted for certain commercial transactions between Iran and the United States, the ban on trade of certain items, and limitations to financial activities might be regarded as relating to certain rights and obligations of the parties to that treaty. The court is therefore satisfied that at least the aforementioned measures, which were complained of by Iran, are indeed prima facie capable of falling within the material scope of the 1955 treaty. The court finds that the above-mentioned elements are sufficient at this stage to establish that the dispute between the parties relates to the interpretation or application of the Treaty of Amity. The court recalls next that under the terms of Article 21, paragraph 2 of the 1955 treaty, the dispute submitted to it must not have been, and I quote, satisfactorily adjusted by diplomacy. In addition, Article 21, paragraph 2 states that any dispute relating to the interpretation or application of the treaty shall be submitted to the court unless the parties agree to settlement by some other pacific means. The court notices that neither party contended that they have agreed to settlement by any other peaceful means. The court recalls that Article 21, paragraph 2 of the 1955 treaty is not phrased in terms similar to those used in certain compromissory clauses of other treaties, which, for instance, impose a legal obligation to negotiate prior to the sesin of the court. Instead, the terms of Article 21, paragraph 2 of the 1955 treaty are descriptive in character and focus on the fact that the dispute must not have been satisfactorily adjusted by diplomacy. Thus, there is no need for the court to examine whether formal negotiations have been engaged in or whether the lack of diplomatic adjustment is due to the conduct of one party or the other. It is sufficient for the court to satisfy itself that the dispute was not satisfactorily adjusted by diplomacy before being submitted to it. In that connection, the court refers to two diplomatic notices sent in June 2018 by the government of Iran to the Embassy of Switzerland, Foreign Interests Section in Tehran, which serves as the channel of communication between the governments of the parties, in the latter of which express mention was made of the obligations of the United States under the 1955 treaty. The court observes that these two notices did not prompt any response from the United States, and that there is no evidence in the case file of any direct exchange on this matter between the parties. As a consequence, the court noticed that the dispute had not been satisfactorily adjusted by diplomacy within the meaning of Article 21, paragraph 2 of the 1955 treaty, prior to the filing of the application on 16 July 2018. In light of the foregoing, the court concludes that prima facie it has jurisdiction pursuant to Article 21, paragraph 2 of the 1955 treaty to deal with the case, to the extent that the dispute between the parties related to the interpretation or application of the said treaty. The power of the court to indicate provisional measures under Article 41 of the statute has as its object the preservation of the respective rights of the parties in a given case, pending its final decision. It follows that the court must be concerned to preserve by such measures the rights which may subsequently be adjudged by it to belong to either party. Therefore, the court may exercise this power only if it is satisfied that the rights asserted by the party requesting such measures are at least plausible. At this stage of the proceedings, the court is thus not called upon to determine definitively whether the rights which Iran wishes to see preserved exist. It need only decide whether the rights claimed by Iran on the merits and which it is seeking to preserve, pending the final decision of the court, are plausible. Moreover, a link must exist between the rights whose protection is sought and the provisional measures being requested. The court observes at the outset that the claims set out in the application of Iran make reference solely to the alleged violations of the 55 Treaty. They do not refer to any provisions of the JCPOA. Under the provisions of the 1955 Treaty invoked by Iran, both contracting parties enjoy a number of rights with regard to financial transactions, the import and export of products to and from each other's territory, the treatment of nationals and companies of the parties, and more generally, freedom of commerce and navigation. The court further noticed that the United States does not, as such, contest that Iran holds these rights under the 1955 Treaty, or that the measures adopted are capable of affecting these rights. Instead, the United States claims that Article 20, Paragraph 1 of the 1955 Treaty entitles it to apply certain measures, inter alia, to protect its essential security interests, and argues that the plausibility of the alleged rights of Iran must be assessed in light of the plausibility of the rights of the United States. The court notes that the rights whose preservation is sought by Iran appear to be based on a possible interpretation of the 1955 Treaty and on the prima facie evidence of the relevant facts. Further, in the court's view, some of the measures announced on 8 May 2018 and partly implemented by Executive Order 13846 of 6 August 2018, such as the revocation of licenses granted for the import of products from Iran, the limitation of financial transactions, and the prohibition of commercial activities, appear to be capable of affecting some of the rights invoked by Iran under certain provisions of the 1955 Treaty. However, in assessing the plausibility of the rights asserted by Iran under the 1955 Treaty, the court must also take into account the invocation by the United States of Article 20, Paragraph 1, subparagraphs B and D of the treaty. The court need not carry out, at this stage of the proceedings, a full assessment of the respective rights of the parties under the 1955 treaty. However, the court considers that insofar as the measures complained of by Iran could relate to fissionable materials, the radioactive byproducts thereof, or the sources thereof, which is provided for under subparagraph B, or could be necessary to protect essential security interests of the United States under paragraph D, subparagraph D, the application of Article 20, paragraph 1, might affect at least some of the rights invoked by Iran under the Treaty of Amity. Nonetheless, the court is of the view that other rights asserted by Iran under the 1955 treaty would not be so affected. In particular, Iran's rights relating to the importation and purchase of goods required for humanitarian needs and to the safety of civil aviation cannot plausibly be considered to give rise to the invocation of Article 20, paragraph 1, subparagraphs B or D. In light of the foregoing, the court concludes that at the present stage of the proceedings, some of the rights asserted by Iran under the 1955 treaty are plausible, insofar as they relate to the importation and purchase of goods required for humanitarian needs, such as medicines and medical devices, foodstuffs and agricultural product commodities, as well as goods and services required for the safety of civil aviation, such as spare parts, equipment, and associated services, including warranty, maintenance, repair services, and safety-related inspections necessary for civil aircraft. The court now turns to the issue of the link between the rights claimed and the provisional measures requested. The court recalls that Iran has requested the suspension of the implementation and enforcement of all measures announced on 8 May 2018 and the full implementation of transactions already licensed. Iran has further requested the court to order that the United States must, within 3 months, report on the action taken with regard to those measures and assure, and I quote, Iranian, U.S. and non-U.S. nationals and companies that it will comply with the order of the court and that it shall cease any and all statements or actions that would dissuade U.S. and non-U.S. persons and entities from engaging or continuing to engage economically with Iran and Iranian nationals or companies, end of quotation. Finally, Iran requests that the United States must refrain from taking any other measure that might prejudice the rights of Iran and Iranian nationals under the 1955 treaty. The court has already found that at least some of the rights asserted by Iran under the 1955 treaty are plausible. It recalls that this is the case with respect to the asserted rights of Iran insofar as they relate to the importation and purchase of goods required for humanitarian needs, as well as goods and services required for the safety of civil aviation. In the view of the court, certain aspects of the measures requested by Iran aimed at ensuring freedom of trade and commerce, particularly in the above-mentioned goods and services, may be considered to be linked to those plausible rights whose protection is being sought. The court concludes, therefore, that a link exists between some of the rights whose protection is being sought and certain aspects of the provisional measures being requested by Iran. The court now turns to the issue of the possible of risk of irreparable prejudice and urgency. The court, pursuant to Article 41 of its statute, has the power to indicate provisional measures when there is a risk that irreparable prejudice could be caused to rights which are the subject of judicial proceedings, or when the alleged disregard of such rights may entail irreparable consequences. However, the power of the court to indicate provisional measures will be exercised only if there is urgency, in the sense that there is a real and imminent risk that irreparable prejudice will be caused before the court gives its final decision. The condition of urgency is met when the act is susceptible of causing irreparable prejudice can occur at any moment before the court makes a final decision on the case. The court must therefore consider whether such a risk exists at this stage of the proceedings. The court is not called upon for the purposes of its decision on the request for the indication of provisional measures to establish the existence of breaches of the Treaty of Amity, but to determine whether the circumstances require the indication of provisional measures for the protection of rights under this instrument. It cannot at this stage make definitive findings of fact, and the right of each party to submit arguments in respect of the merits remains unaffected by the court's decision on the request for the indication of provisional measures. The court notes that the decision announced on 8 May 2018 appears to have already had an impact on the import and export of products originating from the two countries, as well as on the payments and transfer of funds between them, and that its consequences are of a continuing nature. The court notes that as of 6 August 2018, contracts concluded before the imposition of measures involving a commitment on the part of Iranian airline companies to purchase spare parts from the United States companies or from foreign companies selling spare parts partly constituted of U.S. components, appear to have been cancelled or adversely affected. In addition, companies providing maintenance for Iranian aviation have been prevented from doing so when it involved the installation or replacement of components produced under U.S. licenses. Furthermore, the court notes that while the importation of foodstuffs, medical supplies, and equipment is in principle exempted from the United States measures, it appears to have become more difficult in practice since the announcement of the measures by the United States for Iran, Iranian companies, and nationals to obtain such imported foodstuffs, supplies, and equipment. In this regard, the court observes that as a result of the measures, certain foreign banks have withdrawn from financing agreements or suspended cooperation with Iranian banks. Some of these banks also refuse to accept transfers or to provide corresponding services. It follows that it has become difficult, if not impossible, for Iranian companies and nationalists to engage in international financial transactions that would allow them to purchase items not covered in principle by the measures, such as foodstuffs, medical supplies, and medical equipment. The court considers that certain rights of Iran under the 1955 treaty invoked in these proceedings that it has found plausible are of such a nature that the disregard of them may entail irreparable consequences. This is the case in particular for those rights relating to the importation and purchase of goods required for humanitarian needs, such as medicines and medical devices, foodstuffs and agricultural commodities, as well as goods and services required for the safety of civil aviation, such as spare parts, equipment, and associated services necessary for civil aircraft. The court is of the view that a prejudice can be considered as irreparable when the person is concerned are exposed to danger to health and life. In its opinion, the measures adopted by the United States have the potential to endanger civil aviation safety in Iran and the lives of its users to the extent that they prevent Iranian airlines from acquiring spare parts and other necessary equipment, as well as from accessing associated services necessary for civil aircraft. The court further considers that restrictions on the importation and purchase of goods required for humanitarian needs, such as foodstuffs and medicines, including life-saving medicines, treatment for chronic disease or preventive care and medical equipment may have a serious detrimental impact on the health and lives of individuals on the territory of Iran. The court noticed that during the oral proceedings, the United States offered assurances that the United States Department of State would, I quote, use its best endeavors to ensure that humanitarian or safety of flight-related concerns which arise following the reimposition of the United States sanctions receive full and expedited consideration by the Department of the Treasury or other relevant decision-making agencies, end of quotation. While appreciating these assurances, the court considers nonetheless that insofar as they are limited to an expression of best endeavors and to cooperation between departments and other decision-making agencies, the said assurances are not adequate to address fully the humanitarian and safety concerns raised by the applicant. Therefore, the court is of the view that there remains a risk that the measures adopted by the United States, as set out above, may entail irreparable consequences. The court further noticed that the situation resulting from the measures adopted by the United States, following the announcement of 8 May 2018, is ongoing, and that there is at present little prospect of improvement. Moreover, the court considers that there is urgency, taking into account the imminent implementation by the United States of an additional set of measures scheduled for after 4 November 2018. The indication by the court of provisional measures responding to humanitarian needs would not cause irreparable prejudice to any rights invoked by the United States. The court concludes from all of the above considerations that the conditions required by its statute for it to indicate provisional measures are met. It is therefore necessary, pending its final decision, for the court to indicate certain measures in order to protect the rights claimed by Iran as identified above. The court recalls that it has the power under its statute, when a request for provisional measures has been made, to indicate measures that are in whole or in part other than those requested. Article 75, paragraph 2 of the Rules of Court specifically refers to this power of the court. The court has already exercised this power on several occasions in the past. In the present case, having examined the terms of the provisional measures requested by Iran and the circumstances of the case, the court finds that the measures to be indicated need not be identical to those requested. The court considers that the United States, in accordance with its obligations under the 1955 Treaty, must remove, by means of its choosing, any impediment arising from the measures announced on 8 May 2018 to the free exportation to the territory of Iran of goods required for humanitarian needs, such as medicines and medical devices, foodstuffs and agricultural commodities, as well as goods and services required for the safety of civil aviation, such as spare parts, equipment, and associated services necessary for civil aircraft. To this end, the United States must ensure that licenses and necessary authorizations are granted and that payments and other transfers of funds are not subject to any restriction insofar as they relate to the goods and services referred to above. The court recalls that Iran has requested that it indicate measures aimed at ensuring the non-aggravation of the dispute with the United States. When indicating provisional measures for the purpose of preserving specific rights, the court may also indicate provisional measures with a view to preventing the aggravation or extension of a dispute whenever it considers that the circumstances so require. In this case, having considered all the circumstances, in addition to the specific measures it has decided to take, the court deems it necessary to indicate an additional measure directed to both parties and aimed at ensuring the non-aggravation of their dispute. The court reaffirms that its orders on provisional measures under Article 41 of the statute have binding effect and thus create international legal obligations for any party to whom the provisional measures are addressed. The decision given in the present proceedings in no way prejudges the question of the jurisdiction of the court to deal with the merits of the case or any questions relating to the admissibility of the application or to the merits themselves. It leaves unaffected the right of the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran and those of the United States of America to submit arguments in respect of those questions. For these reasons, the court indicates the following provisional measures. 1. Unanimously, the United States of America, in accordance with its obligations under the 1955 Treaty of Amity, Economic Relations and Consular Rights, shall remove, by means of its choosing, any impediments arising from the measures announced on 8 May 2018 to the free exportation to the territory of the Islamic Republic of Iran of medicines and medical devices, foodstuffs and agricultural commodities, and spare parts, equipment, and associated services, including warranty, maintenance, repair services, and inspections necessary for the safety of aviation. Two, unanimously, the United States of America shall ensure that licenses and necessary authorizations are granted and that payments and other transfer of funds are not subject to any restriction insofar as they relate to the goods and services referred to in point one. Three, unanimously, both parties shall refrain from any action which might aggravate or extend the dispute before the court or make it more difficult to resolve. I shall now call on the registrar to read the operative part of the order in French. Vous avez la parole.
Merci, Monsieur le Président. Par ces motifs, la Cour indique à titre provisoire les mesures conservatoires suivantes. 1. À l'unanimité, les États-Unis d'Amérique, conformément à leurs obligations au titre du traité d'amitié, de commerce et de droit consulaire conclu en 1955, doivent, par les moyens de leur choix, supprimer toute entrave que les mesures annoncées le 8 mai 2018 mettent à la libre exportation vers le territoire de la République islamique d'Iran. 1. De médicaments et de matériel médical. 2. De denrées alimentaires et de produits agricoles. Et 3. Des pièces détachées, des équipements et des services connexes, notamment le service après-vente, l'entretien, les réparations et les inspections nécessaires à la sécurité de l'aviation civile. 2. À l'unanimité, les États-Unis d'Amérique doivent veiller à ce que les permis et autorisations nécessaires soient accordés et à ce que les paiements et autres transferts de fonds ne soient soumis à aucune restriction dès lors qu'il s'agit de l'un des biens et services visés au point 1. 3. À l'unanimité, les deux parties doivent s'abstenir de tout acte qui risquerait d'aggraver ou d'étendre le différend dont la Cour est saisie ou d'en rendre la solution plus difficile.
Merci. Judge Cansado, Trinidad appendix a separate opinion to the order of the court. Judge ad hoc Mumtaz appendix a declaration to the order of the court. The text of the order is available from today in TypeScript. It will be available shortly on the court's website. The printed text will be available in due course. As the court has no further business before it today, I declare the sitting closed.
This past weekend, another solidarity action with Julian Assange, who remains holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. There's been a monthly online vigil by journalists and activists that takes place on the first weekend of each month. This past weekend, that vigil began with the following interviews.
Online vigil for Julian Assange. I'm Joe Loria. I'm the editor-in-chief of Consortium News. And I'm very happy here to be invited by Susie Dawson to kick off this 11-hour vigil or 12-hour vigil. We're going to go until, I think, 11 p.m. Eastern Time. It's 10:30 a.m. here in the Washington, D.C. area. I'm joined by Kathy Vogan. Welcome. How are you, Kathy?
I'm good. How are you? It's very late here again. It's just after midnight.
And where are you exactly?
I'm in Sydney, Australia.
And it's
although afternoon. I don't sound like an Aussie. I've got one of those international kid accents that live in too many countries. But yeah, it's 12:30 in the morning, and it's getting quite warm now, so we're having nice weather. I've been I suppose you want to ask what I've been up to next.
Well, let me ask you, tell the audience a little bit about yourself. Tell us about why you're here.
No, they've heard about me 3 times, I think. So, all right, very briefly.
Well, there are people I've never tuned in before, perhaps.
I just don't like talking about myself all that much. All right, so I'm a Franco-Irish Australian artist living in Sydney, and I have been a WikiLeaks supporter since 2010. And I got involved with people close to WikiLeaks. In fact, Julian Assange's mother was the first person that I met close to WikiLeaks. But I met his father, brother, you know, and started making films in relation to WikiLeaks, and proposed to make a documentary for WikiLeaks. And then back in 2011, it was a cliffhanger every single day. So no time to make a long format documentary. It was kind of everything that came out was news, and it turned into a web series of many different interviews, a bit like the Unity for Jay thing, except that, you know, I went traveled around the world instead of doing this, and met up with, you know, people like I went to America, met Noam Chomsky, Daniel Ellsberg, Nozomi Hayase. So I recorded their testimonies. It's a very similar style because it was more like conversation between people who have a common interest in all this, and looking behind the scenes and looking behind the narratives and trying to figure out what's really going on, and also contemplating the benefit of an organization like WikiLeaks with their perfect record of truth-telling. Oh, my goodness, that is gold, and that is something that we need to defend, protect. It was obviously causing a lot of trouble to people whose corruption was being exposed, and people in high places. So lots of people in low places, in grassroots places, but at every level, anybody who had skills should stand up and do whatever they can to defend WikiLeaks. So I made an awful lot of films. I made the WikiLeaks tapes, which was a collection of 24 films with people talking from all around the world. And some of it was actual documentary because I had the time, you know, cameo documentaries, let's say, but up to 20 minutes long. Yeah, and so all of the, you know, people like John Pilger and Christine Assange and his father, John Shipton, as well. We were, you know, we were all working together back in, you know, 2011 onwards here in Sydney, and trying to do the same thing as we are now, stop Julian from being pushed into a precipice, you know, which once again seems surprisingly near. But I've been trying to figure out what the latest drama is all about, what's been happening in Ecuador over the last few days. So, yeah, I don't know if you've heard about that as well.
Can you talk about that? Because we had some news yesterday. Well, supposed news that the Foreign Minister Jose Valencia Mora said that his Julian's status remains the same inside the embassy in London. But really, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, why announce it? Why make such a public international announcement to reaffirm Julian's asylum? Because what they were debating in the Ecuadorian assembly was they were taking a vote on whether to scrutinize the process of giving him citizenship. Now, so whether he keeps his citizenship or not has got nothing to do with whether he remains an asylee. And, you know, the idea, you know, it is the rationale, as WikiLeaks have said it, on October 4th, that is being pushed in order to make him easier to extradite to the US over WikiLeaks publications about the Iraq War, State Department and CIA. Vault 7. Article 79 of the Ecuadorian Constitution forbids extradition of nationals. Once his citizenship is revoked, extradition is easier, but not easy, because you have Ecuador Constitution Article number 41. And this is for this just applies for non-citizens who are applying for citizenship, for asylum, I should say. The state shall respect and guarantee the principle of non-return, right? More technical terms, non-refoulement. In addition to humanitarian and legal emergency assistance. So persons requesting asylum shall not be penalized or prosecuted for remaining in a situation of irregularity. That's Article 41. So Julian is still protected under that. So why should the foreign minister make such a big deal of making this announcement, reaffirming? I suppose it may have been because there was confusion. A lot of people thought that they were voting on whether to revoke his citizenship or not. No, this was just a politician, her name was Paolo Vintimilla, from the Christian Socialist Party, that had put in a request to the foreign minister a number of times already, but, you know, got really quite adamant about it, that they declassify certain documents that were classified by him in relation to the process of giving him citizenship. And we know that a lot of that stuff was very, very private. I am not surprised at all that it was, you know, they had to look at all of the evidence, and a lot of that evidence had not been revealed to the world. So, what, you know, okay, so she's saying that every citizen in Ecuador has the right to see all those documents. That's just rubbish. I mean, that would be a diplomatic issue if all of those documents related with that decision to give him citizenship were revealed.
So you're saying even if they revoked his citizenship, it wouldn't change his status
as an asylee.
But it could still make it easier to extradite him to the U.S. That is key there.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.